to the political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Welcome, everybody, to the Political Cesspool radio program, Saturday evening, June 26th, 2010. I'm your host, James Edwards, joined tonight for the first hour by my co-host, Keith Alexander, as we broadcast to you live once again from AM 1380 WLRM Studios in Memphis, Tennessee, on the Internet, simulcasting at thepoliticalcesspool.org and libertynewsradio.com, and, of course, going out to the AM/FM affiliate stations of the Liberty News Radio Network as well. Ladies and gentlemen, I got to tell you, I have never been at a finer place in my life. I know this is going to disappoint all of my liberal detractors, but truly, I have never been happier. I turned 30 years old last Tuesday on June 22nd, dawning of a new decade. My first show tonight, in fact, in my 30s, I started this show, my first broadcast, I was 24. So we'll see what the next decade holds, Keith, but I'll tell you what, the show has never been doing better. I'm healthy, happy, beautiful wife, beautiful baby, great home. It's going good, Keith, and you're a big part of it, my friend.
Well, this is a labor of love that we do with this show, and I tell you, it's the thing that keeps the juices flowing. We enjoy it. We all enjoy one another's company. And, you know, life is looking up despite all of the rotten decay that we see setting in among us and around us. We love America, and the reason we do this show is that we're trying to get the word out so the people will have the scales fall from their eyes and can take steps needed to save the America that we've grown to know and love prevent it from descending into a third world hellhole.
Keith, to do what you love is always something that man would aspire to do, but to do what you love and have it become as renowned as this program is something that you have to be extremely lucky, fortunate, or very gifted in order to make happen for yourself. And we've talked a great length about the media attention that this show continues to receive and will probably always receive now that we're on the radar screens of just about everyone. But that's neither here nor there. The bottom line is, big week for me, exciting times, the book's doing well, just every aspect I look in my life, it's firing on all cylinders, and I consider myself extremely blessed to be able to say that, and just wanted to share that with my extended family, the audience of the Political Cesspool radio program. Got a birthday present in the form of another review of my book on Tuesday that came from our friends at the Spirit Water Blood blog, and I'm going to share that with you in greater detail in the second hour. But first, Keith Alexander and I got together today at a local barbecue restaurant not far from my home here in Memphis, and we sat down and we were hammering out the topics that we're going to bring to your attention during this, our first hour. And I got to tell you, I think we have really, and I say this every week, but every week it seems to get better and better in my opinion. Keith, we've really laid out for them this evening four very hard-hitting and contemporary topics with our unique political cesspool spin that we think the audience is truly going to enjoy. And I'm going to let you take it from there and let them know what the first one is.
Well, what we have to do every week is sift through a multitude of articles. You know, we're never short of things to talk about. In fact, it's a matter of elimination. We've got to figure out what is going to be the best and what's most important, or what is going to be the most unique. We have a unique role here at the Political Cesspool, and that's to give light so that people can find their own way. The reason we're as significant and have as much impact on the news as we do, being a small radio show in a small market, is because we insist upon telling the truth and telling it in a unvarnished, unfearful way. And, you know, we started off my segment some time ago calling it Behind Enemy Lines. And what I did typically was read the newspaper with discernment to show people that you need to be able to read between the lines to figure out what's going on. If you just take what your local newspaper tells you at face value, you'll be in the dark. But if you really you know, give a penetrating analysis to it, they're going to tell you more than they intend to tell you. And along that line, in the Memphis Commercial Appeal, Friday, June the 18th, the banner headline was Toyota Delivers. Corollas to be assembled at Blue Springs, Mississippi plant. 2,000 jobs expected. And underneath that banner headline, James, is a photograph of all the new employees standing up and cheering as they cut the ribbon for the opening of this new plant. And guess what was so striking to us about this picture?
Now, this is the point where people are going to expect us to say it's 100% non-white. And once again, we are at the wrong end of the totem pole. But Keith, tell them where they're wrong.
Well, what's so incredible about this is that the picture shows, I was able to find two black people in this entire picture, and there must be the entire 2,000 employees here. Now, this is going to come as a shock to people, but let me tell you, the Japanese are no fools. They know where to build their plants, and they know where not to build them. And where they choose not to build them typically are in urban areas or even in rural areas that have a vast percentage or a large percentage of African Americans. They chose Blue Springs, Mississippi, because Blue Springs is in Union County, Mississippi. Now, Mississippi is not uniform in its population and racial demographic distribution. Mississippi generally has a population that's 60.6% white, 37.2% black. Now, they could have built this plant in and around Memphis, but of course Memphis is a big mecca for blacks with a 68% black population. They could have built it in the Delta, where they have 75% plus black populations in towns like Clarksdale and Tunica. But instead, James, they chose Union County, Mississippi, which is where Blue Springs, Mississippi is, that has an 83.3% white population and a 15.5% black population. Now, the question, if you'll look at where all of these Japanese car plants are built, where the German car plants like BMW and Volkswagen in America are built, even where GM plants like Saturn are built, do they go back to Detroit and try to, you know, tap into this reservoir of experienced car manufacturing employees? No. They look for places in the South where you have a right-to-work state, typically. In other words, unions can't be forced upon you. They have to be voted in by the employees. And secondly, they look for places in the South that have a vast majority of white workers. Now, James, why would that be?
Well, Keith, I guess they want their cars to be efficiently assembled, and they want people to report in and do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and that's what they're going to get from the population that is represented there in that particular county of Mississippi.
Well, what they're doing, too, you need to understand that there's a reason why blacks preponderate in the public sector of employment rather than the private sector with private employers like Toyota. They like the public sector for three basic reasons. First of all, they get a defined benefit retirement pension package. That's the only place just about in the entire economy now where you can get that is in public sector employment. What they do is, you know, everyone else is trembling with fear and trepidation whenever they open their quarterly statement on their 401k plan, trying to, you know, hope that they didn't lose too much money in the latest gyrations of the stock market. Meanwhile, these public sector employees, i.e. black employees, know that they are going to get the same check every month if World War III happens. It's going to come rolling in like clockwork. Secondly, they get Cadillac health care. They can ravage their bodies with sexually transmitted diseases, alcoholism, drug abuse, fried chicken, you name it, and they get almost everything paid for 100 cents on the dollar. the best health insurance available is typically available to public sector employees. And thirdly, they can't be fired for being bad employees, for being non-productive, for being chronic absentees.
Keith, hold it right there. Got to take a break. We're going to pick back up on the brand new Toyota plant that has opened up in essentially an all-white area of rural Mississippi down by Tupelo, the birthplace of the king, Elvis Presley. We're going to talk about that and its ramifications right after this.
There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, the first topic on the agenda this evening is a story that we found in the local newspaper here in Memphis, and it depicts the opening of a brand new... Is it a billion-dollar plant here, Keith?
At least. It's a Toyota automobile manufacturing plant. They're going to be manufacturing Corolla model Toyota automobiles.
And they picked a pretty interesting pocket of Mississippi to put this plant.
Right. As we said, Mississippi isn't uniform. A lot of black people think of Mississippi as being one of the homelands for black people in America, that in South Carolina or Alabama or whatnot, but... Mississippi is not all of one piece. And they just happened to choose a section of Mississippi, Union County, Mississippi, that's 83.3% white, 15.5% black, when Mississippi generally is only 60.6% white and 37.2% black. And, of course, the areas, you have basically two designations in Mississippi. You have the hill country, which is basically white because it had hilly land that wasn't good for large-scale farming operations, and then you had the Delta, which is heavily black, you know, 70 to 80% black, typically in Delta County, because that's where the flat, arable land was that would support large-scale farming operations, and that's what they were brought in to do. Well, Toyota is a Japanese company. Japanese business leaders are not beguiled and bewildered and bewitched like Americans with this notion of political correctness and white guilt. So consequently, they want to locate their plants in places where they're going to have a good, strong workforce that has solid middle-class values. They're punctual, they're methodical, they are work-oriented, job-oriented, see jobs through to the end. They don't come in drunk or whatnot. They come in and give you a full day's work for a full day's pay. And isn't it surprising how they just happen to choose an area in Mississippi that is, you know, atypically white, one that has a much larger white percentage than other places where they could have built this plant. And as we said, the reason is, they want good employees.
Well, and of course, Toyota can get away with it to an extent because they, too, are non-white, and so they kind of have a buffer against that whole baseless racist accusation. I mean, you are, of course, racist if you want efficient workers in your business, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, see, they don't want to have a running guerrilla war with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, set up by the infamous 1964 Civil Rights Act. They do not want a government lawsuit questioning every hiring decision, every firing decision, every promotion decision, every demotion decision that they make, and that's exactly what they would face if they located, let's say, in a Delta County and had a vast majority of blacks. Furthermore, they would have a very inefficient workforce. Blacks have tended to perfect this passive-aggressive technique of looking like they're working and getting very little done. That's why they always gravitate whenever possible, into public sector employment, because they don't have to be productive as public sector employees. They're not productive because the public sector doesn't produce anything. It just absorbs tax money. And, of course, the more public sector employees we have, the higher our taxes are going to be.
Well, Keith, I love it. You know, I think the Toyota company down there is going to be making some very fine Corollas here on American soil. And they'll have a pretty good workforce to make sure it gets done right. And good for Union County, Mississippi, with 11% unemployment at last count. That's certainly going to go down. And I'm sure some good, upstanding, red-blooded, hard-working, tax-paying Southerners are going to get some good-paying jobs.
And aren't you, you know, isn't it amazing that the local newspaper, the national news, no one else picks up on this? Because they know it would redound to the discredit of blacks. And, of course, they can't acknowledge that there are racial differences. The Japanese know that there are racial differences. The Germans, who have built BMW and Volkswagen plants in the South and in America, likewise locate them in the same predominantly white areas each and every time, because they know what they would be getting if they locate in a black area. They'd be borrowing trouble, as we say here in the South.
The Japanese are among the most homogenous people in the world, of that you can be sure. So, you know, they're not going to brainwash themselves on the flight from Japan to Mississippi and lose all of their scruples. I mean, what they know there, they're going to apply here, and good for them. Now, so that's good news. We're starting out the show with some good news for a change.
But hidden news. Hidden news.
Hidden news and good news.
Now, want you to know about.
You are always going to get nuggets of news here on the political cesspool that you're going to be hard-pressed to find anywhere else. We found news sources from local markets and bring them to your attention on this very national and internationally renowned program, because, of course, without us doing that, you'd never hear about some of these things. And, of course, what we talk about from these markets certainly have ramifications for all of us. But one of the things that Keith and I are going to be doing to an extent during this first hour as well tonight is touching on some very big, some of the biggest national news stories in the country this week, and providing to you our unique spin on those. One of those is the Gulf oil leak there that everyone knows so much about. We're going to tackle that in a moment. But first, General McChrystal, Keith, what's going on there and what's significant about it that we're going to bring to the audience's attention that all of the mainstream news entities have left out thus far?
Well, as usual, we give a different spin. We see things through the looking glass, and we know what's going on, and we are willing to say that the emperor has no clothes, where the rest of the media is cowed, confused, and helpless. Well, the McChrystal affair, let's look at it and do some analysis that you're not going to get elsewhere.
But tell them what happened first, in case anybody's been on Mars lately.
Okay, well, McChrystal was interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine, and again, some duplicitous reporter got into his confidence, and he wrote an article that is full of McChrystal's staff, for the most part, slamming the Obama administration, particular individuals in it, saying they're a bunch of boobs, they're incompetent, they have no idea on how to run a war, they are making things unnecessarily dangerous for our troops over there. Now, there was only one quote directly from McChrystal. Most of them were from his staff, but on the basis of that article, Obama sends out an order for McChrystal to come to Washington, and he summarily fires him. Now, everybody in the mainstream, conservative mainstream, liberal mainstream, says, well, it's unfortunate because McChrystal was a good soldier. But, you know, we have to do this because the commander-in-chief needs respect. You have to respect the office even if you don't respect the man, and as a result, that was an appropriate thing to do. End of story. But see, they're dealing with style, James, not substance. What was the substance of McChrystal's objections to Obama's way of running the war in Afghanistan? And by the way, McChrystal was the commander of the Afghanistan campaign that's going on now. What was wrong, according to McChrystal, is exactly what we've been saying for years here on the cesspool. He objects to the American military being used as the police force for one world government. Basically, there are rules of engagement, and that's what he was complaining about, that require a American Armed Forces personnel not to fire on insurgents until they're fired upon, because the insurgents aren't wearing uniforms. They dress like the rest of the population, and as a result, they're going to, you know, they can't be easily distinguished according to the liberals.
Hold on right there, Keith. We're going
to be a police force.
Got to pick up on McChrystal right after this break. Got to pay the bills. We'll be back.
Successful, guys. We'll be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
All right, everybody. Keith Alexander was providing analysis and commentary before we went to the break on the McChrystal affair, what it means for the so-called war effort, and a couple of other unique opinions that you'll find only here. So with that being said, I'm going to let Keith continue on. Keith?
Well, the substance of McChrystal's objections are that it's not a war effort, it's a police effort. What has happened since World War II without the consent of either the military or the consent of the American people is that our armed forces have been transformed into the police force for one world government. You know, whenever the United Nations wants to quell an uprising in some part of the world, they send out troops, the majority of which are American troops, like Kosovo, for example. I remember in the Kosovo campaign under Clinton in the Balkans, where we basically carved out a Muslim state in Christian Serbia, again, totally turning our back on our heritage and on our people. Well, they wanted American troops to wear sky blue helmets like UN forces, and there is an uproar about that. Then, recently, the Obama administration came up with a new medal for armed service personnel for valorous restraint. In other words, you didn't shoot, you didn't defend, you didn't do something in they want, under circumstances in which they thought it was judicious and smart for us to do that. All of this is indicative of the fact that we're no longer fielding a normal army. A normal army wants to defeat and demoralize and, if necessary, kill the enemy. Our military is now not only not programmed to do that, a soldier that goes into battle with that attitude is more than likely going to be court-martialed. What's going to happen is, you know, we have 35,000 troops in Korea to keep a lid on things. We've sent our armed forces at great expense to both Iraq and Afghanistan, not to defeat the indigenous people or those nations, but instead to keep a lid on things. And this is a very expensive enterprise and undertaking. It's very frustrating for the military because a military isn't set up to do that. What we're doing is our leaders treasonously have allowed our wealth and our resources, including our military resources, to be used for a purpose that is unconstitutional, which is to use our military as a police force. And, of course, they'd like to do it in America, too. We had an article we were talking about, again, in the Memphis newspaper of Thursday, June the 12th, 2010, the title headline is Air Force, Elite German Troops Leap into Tennessee Skies and Lifestyles. They're basically sending foreign troops in America to train, both paratroop training and firearms training in North Mississippi, paratroop training in West Tennessee. They're doing this because they want them to get used to America. They're sending our troops, our American boys and girls, overseas, and then if there's an uprising in America, they're going to be sending foreign troops who won't have any compunction about shooting you, me, and everybody else from foreign countries like Germany, like Eastern Europe. Hispanic people are being enticed into the American armed services with promises they'll be granted citizenship if they serve out their tour of duty. All of these things are very ominous, and McChrystal was complaining about this, and because he dared to complain, he's history.
Well, Keith, you and I talked about it today. So many things in play here. First of all, let's not forget that the United States hasn't declared war since the Second World War. There probably hasn't been a war that should have been fought, I think it could be argued, since the Confederates went into battle to defend their homeland. Above and beyond that, now you've got a military that is basically just a global police force. They don't even try to go and win the wars that they're engaged in anymore. Obama comes up with this Yellow Heart Award that awards people for getting shot at but not shooting back. He fires people who try to move forward with an agenda. A lot of crazy stuff going on. But another thing we addressed at the lunch today, Keith, was that America still has these military bases that you mentioned and ports of call all around the globe. Now, why does that occur? Because you had a very interesting analysis. I said, well, why don't these countries just get rid of us? We, of course, wouldn't want other nations setting up bases in our country. And you provided a great and succinct answer to that.
Well, the reason, particularly in Europe, that they do this is because we have liberated all of Europe, particularly Western Europe, all the NATO nations, and of course they're constantly expanding NATO, from the responsibility, the financial responsibility of providing an army for their own defense and a navy. All of them have been cut back, and they use that money that used to be spent on maintaining a military to maintain a welfare state, a socialist government welfare state in each of their nations, and that even with us taking over the burden of their defense, which, of course, we don't want to do, it's not in the best interest of the American people. It gets us nothing but ill will throughout the world by doing it. What it does is it frees up their money, but they've run out of money even under this freed-up new regime. Greece has such an extensive welfare state, they can't pay the bills, they can't pay the pensions, they can't pay the public employees. And when they tried to cut back in what they called austerity measures, the Greek people rioted in the streets. So they promptly went to the Germans and a few of the more prosperous European countries and got them to bail Greece out. But the whole thing is going down. And that's why we're doing it. If we would follow the prescription of the Founding Fathers, particularly George Washington, to avoid favorite nation status and foreign wars, as he said in his farewell address, we would be so incredibly wealthy, it's a beggar's belief. You would not imagine how much money we're spending, for example, to maintain 35,000 troops since 1952 on the Korean Peninsula, and plus troops in forts and fortresses and outposts all over the world, discharging our unofficial duty as the police force for one world government.
Well, another good analysis there from Keith Alexander on a very important topic, a topic that you've no doubt seen just about everywhere, the dealing of the McChrystal situation by their president. And so, Keith, now also another issue with which Obama is intimately engaged, or at least appears to be, the crisis, if you will, in the Gulf and how they're trying to castrate America's ability to produce its own energy. What's going on there? What's really going on there, Keith?
Two things, basically, James. Let's get to them. The first thing is, this is emblematic. It's a parable about the consequences of the deindustrialization of America. In 1950, America manufactured 96% of all the goods and services that we consumed in America. Today, in 2010, the manufacturing sector is down to 12% of the economy. And as a result of that deindustrialization, where has it all gone? We're not consuming less. We're actually consuming more. We're allowing third world nations, again, in concert with the desires of the globalists and the one worlders, the CFR people, the Trilateral Commission, all of these type of people. Everything's being manufactured on the Pacific Rim, in China, Taiwan, Japan, India. Mexican labor is now too expensive for them. But because of all of that, we no longer have the ability to fix a leaking oil well in the Gulf. I guarantee in 1950, James, if we could drill the oil well, we could fill the oil well, we could fix the leak, if a leak developed in an American oil well. Now, we have to look to other countries. Other countries are lining up, begging to come in and fix the oil leak, but Obama doesn't want it fixed. He won't waive the Jones Act, which requires that American companies be used in American unions. But that's just part of the reason. The biggest part of the reason is he wants to be able to point to the oil leak in the Gulf as an example of what comes from dependence on hydrocarbon fuels like oil and gas. You know, we had that coal mine disaster earlier in the year where 25 miners were killed, and now we've got this oil well catastrophe in the Gulf. Perfect example. Remember Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff at the White House, said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, that's what they are intending, and that's what they're doing with the Gulf oil spill. It's not being fixed, and we're not even bringing in the foreigners who can fix it, because he wants to point to it as a morality tale and say, see, this is why you need to pass my cap-and-trade bill, and we're going to be liberated from all these hydrocarbon fuels like oil and gas.
Hold on there, Keith. More on the oil spill in the Gulf, ladies and gentlemen, when James Edwards and Keith Alexander return on the Political Cesspool radio program.
Back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, topics covered thus far tonight on the Political Cesspool radio program include the big new Toyota plant that has found a nest there in a relatively rural, all-white pocket of Mississippi. Near Tupelo. What else have we covered, Keith? We talked about General McChrystal. We have talked about the Gulf oil spill. I'm going to give you an opportunity to finish up your analysis on that issue before we pound Glenn Beck one more time, before moving on to the second hour of tonight's broadcast. Keith?
The Gulf oil spill is basically an embarrassment to America, and it should be an embarrassment to America. And this is what Ross Perot meant back in 92. When he ran for president and said, we need to have a manufacturing base in America. He said, if we lose the capability of manufacturing rolled steel, what are we going to fight the next war with? Potato chips? He had a point. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. We've been deindustrialized to such an extent that our oil industry can't cap a leaking oil well. And, you know, it's an embarrassment. America, with its Yankee ingenuity and its ability, you know, its can-do attitude, has been emasculated by people like George H.W. Bush, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and all of these globalists that have connived so that we've passed laws like NAFTA and GATT and the this new trade agreement between Canada, United States, Mexico, Central America, and whatnot, so that all of our manufacturing jobs have dried up and relocated secretly and without fanfare to other parts of the world where cheap labor abounds. Not only does it decimate the blue-collar middle class in America, it prevents us from protecting ourselves. It prevents us from being a self-sufficient nation. You know, it was Abraham Lincoln who said, of all people, he said, America is so blessed with abundant natural resources and so naturally protected by two large moats called the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean, that he concluded that America must either endure forever or die by suicide.
And what did we say about that quote from Lincoln?
It said that even a blind hog will find a good acorn every once in a while, right? But what it shows, though, is that even compared to the traitors we have running America today, Abraham Lincoln looks like a patriot. You know, that's what it's so,
that's sad. That's sad.
It is really sad that, Abraham Lincoln looked like a traitor compared to people like George Washington, James Madison, Nathaniel Macon, you know, all the other founding fathers, Patrick Henry, people like that. That's how far we've fallen in 200 years, people. And this is, you know, it's an embarrassment that we have reached this point. But this is this should be a toxin in the night. This should be a clarion call to America. If we can't fix an oil well that's leaking, then we had no business drilling it in the first place. We have plenty of oil in America. That's one of the other great fallacies, the idea that we have to depend on foreign oil. I know that we have enough oil in West Texas, in the shale oil deposits in Wyoming, on the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, on the low, you know, the shallow continental shelf around the United States. We could be totally self-sufficient in petroleum if we wanted to. We have never-ending resources of coal, which, you know, burns very cleanly now. We use it in Memphis, and that's all that we use to produce electricity and most of our power. And as a result of that, we could be sufficient. We do not need to be dependent on the rest of the world, and that's the lesson that we think everybody should draw from this Gulf oil spill. And we don't need traitorous people that are going to try to spin this disaster dishonestly, like the Obama administration, and say all it shows is our need to wean ourselves from hydrocarbon fuels like oil and coal.
All right, now, Keith, finally for this first hour, if people can stand any more insightful thinking that we can provide. Glenn Beck, last week, old Glenn, I tell you, he struggles sometimes.
Old Glenn Beck is just infected with political correctness. That guy has a terminal case of political correctness.
It's a disease. It's a disease. A disease of the mind, and old Glenn's eating up with it. Anyway, on his show, and we put this on our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. By the way, when you go to thepoliticalcesspool.org, don't forget my brand new book is out. It is selling like hotcakes. I tell you, it has exceeded expectations. We need your support. We need you to consider buying a copy for yourself. The title.
And the reason we need you to.
Tell them why, Keith.
Because we need you to get the word out, to tell your friends and neighbors who are vaguely conservative what real conservative thought is and what it's all about. They need to have the scales fall from their eyes. All that has to happen to save America, ladies and gentlemen, is for that light bulb to come on over the heads of enough people. And that's what James's book is designed to do. That's going to flip the switch and turn that light bulb on over their heads. So please buy numerous copies. We've kept the price low on purpose so people could do this. Get them out to your friends. Cast to, you know, bread on the water, as they say, you know, and hopefully it'll not come back as burnt toast, but it will come back as, you know, a whole new cadre of right-thinking conservative Americans who know the difference between a loaf and a stone or a fish and a serpent, as they say in the Bible.
The title of the book, Racism, Schmacism, How Liberals Use the R-Word to Push the Obama Agenda. Buy it online tonight at thepoliticalcesspool.org. And the reason I bring that up is because if there's one person in the world who needs to read this book, it's Glenn Beck. Last week on his TV show, we blogged about it. In fact, even included the video on our website. He was educating everyone. In fact, breaking the news that had for, you know, 200-plus years been kept a secret from us about the black founding fathers. You probably didn't know there exist, and again, as we said last week, there's good reason for that. They didn't. But that didn't stop Glenn Beck from providing his soliloquy. Well, he has provided somewhat of a part two to that, has he not, Keith?
Oh, look, the guy, he sees everything in terms of political correctness. He cannot take a position against or for anything unless he can buttress it with some type of spurious facts or information showing that black people either believe this too or they were at the forefront. The whole palaver about the black founding fathers is that the founding fathers, obviously, in his heart of hearts, couldn't be righteous, good men worthy of being followed today unless there was a black contingent among them. And, of course, there was not a black contingent among them. But he insists on saying that there were. The examples he's brought up are, for the most part, you know, the innocent, you know, the inevitable fact that there were a few blacks, most of them servants, most of them slaves, things like this, that were in the vicinity of the real founding fathers of America at the time of the Revolution, and he tries to put them to the forefront. It's a totally dishonest enterprise, but that's what he does. You know, the other thing we pointed out was that almost daily on his show, he pays homage to one of the worst people to ever obtain prominence in the United States, and that was Martin Luther King. He made plays for everything in skirts. He hired prostitutes, beat them up, sexually abused them, physically abused them. He was a Marxist. He consorted with communists. He got his money through Stanley Levinson, who was the bag man for the Communist Party in the United States. But he insists upon portraying Martin Luther King as the first and most authentic conservative in modern America. And, you know, we've got a note to Glenn Beck. People that are paragons of morality and goodness don't have to have their FBI files sealed for 50 years like Martin Luther King's had. If people knew what were in those files, they would never have made Martin Luther King Day a national holiday. And Glenn Beck is just addle-headed. That's all I can say. The latest thing that he came up with is that unions are bad and has nothing to do with economic efficiency, has nothing to do with criminal corruption under the Teamsters or any other group. It has to do with the fact that some of the founders of these unions were, by today's standards, horror of horrors, racist. You know, can you believe it? That we're... The reason to be opposed to unions, and the only legitimate reason to be opposed to unions, is that they were conceived in that original sin of America called racism, James.
Keith, you have outdone yourself tonight once again, my friend. Great commentary on some pretty big subjects going on in the world today, at least in America. McChrystal and the Gulf Oil spill provided our unique commentary on Glenn Beck and the Toyota plant opening up in Mississippi, which is a good thing, of course, for the reasons we've already mentioned, and that is just the first hour, friends. Two more hours still forthcoming tonight, and believe me, the reason Keith drove most of the commentary for this hour is because I'm laying in wait, baby. I'm getting warmed up, about to let loose for two more. We have a great division of labor here in the political cesspool. We carry each other, and I'm going to carry the show for a little while when I come back right after this.
Right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and says, "Something's got a hold on me." The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his Fruit of the Looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the Amen.